This is Carte Blanche, the podcast. One story every day that matters. Delve into the issues that impact you. Whether you're in need of a better understanding of the world around you or simply seeking inspiration or unique perspectives, you'll find it all here.
If anybody's paying more attention to your child than you, you have a problem.
Several schools have been linked to a criminal investigation that exposed a ring of alleged predatory teachers and sporting coaches.
These perpetrators are somebody that we would like.
He was kind of a teacher that every boy loved.
It happens in an environment filled with power, secrecy. If I speak out, I betray the brotherhood.
Boys don't want to be seen as weak. You're the man.
And that's where one bad thing led to another.
You can only have these things happen in a school if the kids already thought, well, this is just normal.
So it's like a cult.
There was no care about what happened to the kids.
And that was to try and protect the school. You're supposed to protect the children in the school.
Please note that today's episode covers adult topics and is not suitable for younger listeners. South Africa's education landscape faces a sobering reality. Alongside issues like bullying, substance abuse and vandalism, rampant sexual abuse and grooming add to the burden experienced by many schoolchildren. Many cases go unreported, but the statistics paint a clear picture of a trend that demands urgent attention. Having recently launched on Mnet Channel 101, a four-part documentary series called School Ties takes a sobering look at a culture of grooming and sexual abuse within some of the country's most elite private schools. We're joined by series producer Richard Gregory to find out more about Operation Nemo, a specialized police investigation into sports coaches targeting vulnerable students, and why school ties should serve as a wake-up call for parents and educators alike.
Hi there, Richard, and welcome to the show. First off, how are you doing now that the first episode of School Ties has gone to air?
Thanks for having me on, Lizanne. It's been a good few days since the first episode aired. There have been lots of messages sent, largely people quite shaken by what they've seen. I think us working on it, we almost forget how impactful it is when you're coming across this material for the first time. But that's been really gratifying in a way, because people are shaken by it, but in a way that makes them incensed and motivated to do something about it.
Now, School Ties is a four-part documentary series that looks at the grooming and sexual abuse of learners at some of South Africa's most prestigious boys' schools, and it's a really heavy topic, but it's such an important one as well. Tell me, what inspired this documentary? Where did it all start for you?
So, as a production team, I think we had seen over the last months, years, that in the news, you keep on getting these stories cropping up of another coach being accused of sexually abusing or grooming boys, or another teacher. And it's frustrating to see that happen over and over, because you think, well, aren't there learnings that you can get from when these things happen that can help other schools to close the loopholes before it turns into another sexual abuse case? Mm-hmm. And so I think it was born out of just seeing that and wondering if there were patterns we could identify, if there were things we could learn that could hopefully be shared and to do something about that.
Can you tell me a bit more about what you want the series to do in terms of the conversations around school abuse, especially at boys' schools, and what you hope to see come from this series once the final episode has aired?
I think the thing that we do want people to understand is, firstly, why we focus on the elite schools and the elite boys' schools. There's schools of all different strata in our society, as everyone knows. Abuse and grooming is something that almost every school is going to need to confront at some point. In fact, the incidences of abuse that happened at the less resourced, underfunded government schools are higher. However, it's of a different type. The abuse that happens in the public schools, in the less privileged schools, tends to be more straightforward. It tends to violate boundaries of physical abuse very clearly. It gets reported more quickly and therefore gets stopped. The perpetrators tend to get caught more quickly. What we saw, though, in the elite schools is that it tends to be a lot more insidious. These are schools that the boys who attend them are very aware of the fact that they are lucky and privileged to be able to attend those schools. It's part of the prestige that the schools have. And the boys don't want to do anything that's going to jeopardize their position at that school. Added to that, there's often decades, sometimes centuries of tradition that go into them. There's a fierce culture of loyalty. And the flip side of that is, in some cases, this can lead to a code of silence, a code of not being allowed to speak out when something like this happens, out of fear of jeopardizing the reputation of the school. So that's one of the disincentives that boys in these elite schools often have. You also have sports like water polo, which you generally only find at the better schools, at the bigger elite schools. They have the resources for it. And those are the kind of sports where coaches have been known to use the cover of practice to be under the water with the boys, to be touching genitals, to be saying this is all part of what's involved in a very rough sport underwater and what they can expect in water polo games. And so there's a normalization of contact, of sexualized contact, of physical abuse that can happen within these schools. So when you put all these things together, you've got a culture of boys who are disincentivized to speak out, a school culture which sometimes values loyalty above all else, and perpetrators who are kind of given the cover in which to do what they want to do. And that's why there's a particular modus operandi that we are showing through the series that is quite distinctive. What it means is that the perpetrators often get away with it for years and sometimes decades, and that can leave hundreds of boys abused in their wake. And that's why we chose these particular cases to look at, to try to do what we can to put a stop to that.
Now, male sexual abuse is often also not spoken of because of the various reasons that you've listed as well, but also there's a stigma around it. And I think this series does a very good job of dispelling these kinds of stigmas, and it also encourages others to come forward, which is really, I think, the core point of documentaries like these, because as you've just said, there is this code of silence that permeates within many of these schools, and the only way you can get to a point of breaking that code of silence is by getting people to start speaking about it. Have you seen throughout the course of working on this series that there has been this movement, in a sense, of people now wanting to talk about their experiences and be more open about it?
Look, it's been a mixed bag. And sometimes that's influenced by the school culture, which might perpetuate. And it's going to depend on the leadership of the school and their willingness to do what it takes to change a culture. And sometimes it's going to be for just personal reasons, whatever the personal situations are of the boys. But I think you're absolutely right, is that especially in South African society, I think we live in quite a hyper-masculinized society, and that's emphasized by a lot of these prestigious schools as well. I'm not saying it's inherently a bad thing, but when allowed to take its course in a way that isn't structured, then it can turn into kind of a pool of toxic masculinity, which does things like instill senses of shame in boys if there's any sort of same-sex sexual contact or if there's any sort of abuse that takes place. There's a sense of snitches get stitches, boys must never speak out, must never tell on, things like that. So those barriers, those sort of hyper-masculine barriers need to be broken down. But that's not something that comes from the boys themselves. That's something that needs to be brought about by the school, by the societal structures that surround them. And I think that's one of the points that we try to make in the series, is that one of our experts, Luke Lumpwerk, makes the statement that being a teenage boy is like having the keys to a Ferrari and no brakes. They need guidance in how to deal with their urges and impulses and all those kind of things. And that's really where the school needs to be giving that guidance. If you don't give that guidance, then you get things like horrible initiation rituals and stuff like that, which you don't really want to allow to happen. So we have seen some change. We have seen, definitely through some of the stories that have been told to us, boys who are willing to speak out, who are willing to go through the very difficult time that they have when they do speak out for this greater goal of more transparency, of trying to bring about change in our society.
How did you convince the survivors and victims' families to speak to you? Because I understand there was some hesitation around sitting down with your team, and rightfully so, because as you've said earlier, there's a lot at stake for many of these learners. How do you convince these devastated individuals to sit down and tell their stories?
To be honest, I think convince is is the wrong word. We wouldn't want to go into this in any way trying to sort of coerce families or survivors to talk to us. We spoke to a number of people and we asked them if they were ready to tell their stories. We told them what our goal was, what we planned to do, and invited them to be a part of that. And we only worked with families who said, yes, they do want to be a part of that. And their impulse to do that was really because in two of the cases we're going to be examining, unfortunately, resulted in the loss of their child's life, taking their own life. You know, all of the production team, we're all parents, we all happen to be parents to boys. So this is really stuff that hits home, hits very close to home. So we went about it as sensitively as we could and just laid out what we planned to do. And we were very encouraged to see that these families said, yes, we do want to take part. We do want to speak to you, because what would add additional burden to the heartbreak was to think that the loss of the child's life had been in vain. At least through participating in a series like this, they can try to share their experiences. They can try help other parents in schools see what the red flags are. They can try help schools identify where the sort of loopholes are that perpetrators can use to carry out what they want to do. And if it can save just one other boy from abuse, then them sharing their story would have been worthwhile.
I also want to look at another element that really struck me. And this is also just from having followed the various headlines over the last couple of years. There's almost this sense that South Africa has in some way become a safe haven for pedophiles. We've seen individuals from the UK and Australia make their way here in recent years, allegedly abusing pupils at these elite schools. Would you agree that SA has become a safe haven? And what are authorities doing to address this?
I don't have the data on what our sort of incidences of abuse are compared to other countries, so I can't comment on that. What I can comment on is that we do have some people, for example, Lieutenant Colonel Helen Niemand. She heads up what's been called Operation Nemo, and she deals with other forms of looking at child sex abuse material offenders, looking at various forms of sexual assault and grooming. She's incredibly driven. She's very capable. It was really heartening to meet people like that in the police force, to meet some of the prosecutors, to meet some of the private legal counsel like Ian Levitt, who really go into battle every day to try and do what they can to stop this from taking place. So it's not hopeless. It's not like somebody can come here and act with impunity. There are very, very good people who are going to do their best to stop perpetrators from doing what they do, to try and keep our children safe. Unfortunately, we all know that in a country like South Africa, our justice system is stretched, our legal system is stretched, our police services are stretched. So it probably is not nearly as much done as we would like. And that's part of what our goal was as well, is saying we can't just leave it to police or other authorities to catch the perpetrators. What we can do is empower people with knowledge so that they can look for the red flags, or when they come across red flags, understand exactly what the processes are that they should be following to deal with that.
And you've just mentioned Operation Nemo, and I know you kind of really dig into this element of the series only in episode 4, really. But I want to find out, firstly, how you were allowed inside this special task force, because it is such a sensitive investigation. Were you approached by the police or did you approach them? How did that all happen?
No, we approached the police. We contacted Colonel Niemand. There's certain channels that you need to follow to be able to approach the police, and you need to get vetted and okayed by those channels, which is an important step. And because of the work that we've done as a production company at Idea Candy, we've had various dealings with the police in this capacity over the years. So there is a level of trust that has been built up, and that gave us some access. And then just when we outlined what it is that we're doing, we realized that we really have the same goals as the police in this case, is just to try to lessen the ability of the perpetrators to act. And so it's been a very productive and fruitful collaboration with them. Obviously, we can't disclose everything that we've learned from these investigations on screen. It had to be vetted very carefully to make sure that we weren't letting out any details that might jeopardize an active investigation. But that's been a relatively easy process to handle. It's just been a matter of making sure that the police knows what we're showing on screen, knows what we're talking about, and can have their input on that.
What has been some of the more surprising elements, some of the things that you didn't really expect that threw you a little bit?
I think the one thing that was surprising is how perpetrators are able to get away with it. Sometimes it's through legal means. Sometimes it's just through putting obstacles in the path of various legal challenges as things go along. And in other ways, it was almost disappointing to see how some of our legal system is structured. And getting some insight into that was not great. For example, things like what the law says about grooming versus sexual abuse. Grooming is a crime in itself. However, somebody can't be charged with grooming alone. They first need to be charged with sexual assault of some form, and then grooming can be added on as an additional charge to be prosecuted with. And that's a shame, because it means that grooming is the point at which sexual assault hasn't happened or hasn't happened yet. You would like to think that you can stop perpetrators at that point and not need it to progress any further before the police can get involved. So that was one of the distressing things that we found out, that people are actively trying to change, get the law changed around that so that can work differently. The second one is just, and this was more out of a lot of sympathy for the survivors who we spoke to, how many times they need to tell their stories to go through the legal system. It might be the first time which they choose to disclose, which might be the most difficult. Could be to a friend, could be to a parent, could be to a teacher. They'll then need to recount that story again to the headmaster of that school. Depending on where it goes from there, they could need to recount that to a social worker. It could be directly to the police. If it turns into a prosecution, it'll be again for the sake of the prosecutors. If it then needs to go to the South African Council for Educators, who should be disbarring or banning a teacher, taking away their certification so they can't continue to teach, they'll then need to tell their story again. A survivor can tell their story a dozen times over the course of this to try and get something to happen. And each time they tell their story, is re-traumatizing. What that means is that they might get a few steps down that path and they or their families might say, that's it, enough. This is re-traumatizing my child who's already experienced grooming or abuse, and they're just not seeing enough happening and they drop it. And unfortunately, it's at that point that perpetrators can get away with it and can continue elsewhere.
Yeah. Now, as this is still an ongoing investigation, did you get any idea from authorities in terms of what needs to happen next to break down this system of abuse?
From the legal cases and the prosecution, I can't comment on that. They would prefer we don't give any more information about that. What I can comment on is from the school side, though. And this is where we think this series can have the most immediate impact and easy impact. So one of the things that I must emphasize is that we're not trying to destroy the schools that are involved. These are, by and large, fantastic schools who are doing mostly a great job of bringing up young men. They are elite schools for a reason. They give a well-rounded, great education, and we're not denying that. We're not trying to break that down. What we are saying is that there are some really easy wins that these schools can implement today. That means that their students are better protected. Things like simply asking themselves, and I hope a lot of people ask themselves this after seeing episode one, is there a WhatsApp policy in place? There shouldn't be any opportunity for any member of staff to be contacting or communicating with a student directly one-on-one via WhatsApp or text message or Instagram direct messages or anything else. At the moment, it's a very convenient communication tool, so it needs to be used. But what the schools can say immediately is, here's our policy. No, there can't be direct communication without at least one other staff member also on the WhatsApp group or one of the parents in a WhatsApp group, just so that every communication can be vetted, can be seen that it's above board. There can be no sense of gaslighting or deniability on the part of the perpetrator saying, oh, it was just an innocent communication. I was asking if they're ready for the water polo training on Saturday or something like that. If there's a policy in place, it's just crossing a boundary, it's crossing a line, and steps can be taken. And that sort of early intervention can already start to prevent the opportunities that perpetrators can have to groom children. It could be things like having policies about one-on-one meetings between staff and pupils. Again, that's one where they can say, well, there shouldn't be any one-on-one meetings. There should be at least two staff members present, or the staff member and the pupil, plus at least one other pupil or a parent. or if it's in a counseling session, for example, where there's a school counselor, there needs to be glass doors or cameras in classrooms. There's so many different ways that this can be done that I think schools can very easily see the opportunities to improve the systems, to closing loopholes so that perpetrators can't get away from it. Mm. And, you know, any teacher who's got nothing to hide will welcome these measures because it'll remove them from suspicion.
Finally, I just want to find out from you, what has been the response from the families, the survivors, to the series? Obviously, the first episode aired last week, Thursday. What has been their response, if you're allowed to take us into that a little bit?
I think I can. Their response overwhelmingly has been gratitude that somebody has taken up this cause, that is doing the series, gratitude that somebody is telling their story. And also what should be very clear to everyone watching the series is that we've very much focused on the survivors and the victims and their families. We're not focused too much on the perpetrators. And I think that's where a lot of documentary work can be criticized, especially in recent years. Documentaries that work in the true crime space, I wouldn't classify this as true crime, but those that do, can be criticized for focusing too much on the perpetrator and salacious details and things like that to get an audience in. And we deliberately don't do that. We are far more interested in the stories of the families. We want to put those front and center, and in that way, honor the victims where they haven't survived, honor the survivors where they've come forward. And I think the families have responded amazingly well to that. And that gives us heart that this difficult process that we all embarked on has been worthwhile.
Thank you so much, Richard. This has been a wonderful chat. And thanks for taking us into the production process and kind of your personal experiences working on this. I think it's such an important series that I believe everyone needs to see. Of course, our listeners can watch School Ties every Thursday until the 6th of June on Mnet Channel 101. It airs at 9 p.m. And then, of course, if you've missed any of the episodes, you can find it on DSTV Catch Up or on the DSTV Stream app. So definitely go check it out. Be part of the conversation. And let's keep this very, very important conversation going, because clearly movement is happening and it's movement in the right direction. And that's always, I think, as documentary makers, what you want to see.
Great. Thanks so much for having us on.
Thanks for listening. We love hearing from our listeners, so why not comment on today's show using hashtag carte blanche. Remember to watch School Ties every Thursday at 9 p.m. until the 6th of June, only on Mnet Channel 101.